Our collective nightmare. A man's car dies in a blizzard on the night before Thanksgiving 1980. He walks through wet snow, finds a farmhouse with the porch light burning, walks up a long driveway, opens an unlocked door, and makes himself a cup of quiet luck. An 18-year-old named John Morris had no phone to call for a tow, no social feed to broadcast his misfortune, only a 1969 Chevy Nova that wouldn't climb out of a ditch, and a weather report that might as well have been written in ancient Greek. He knocks on one house. The man lets him use a landline and says he's leaving. He stumbles on, finds a second house, a dog, an unlocked door, an empty kitchen, and a phone with a rotary silence. He sits. He calls his family. He cleans some dishes. He leaves a note and cash on the table because manners were still cheap that night, and he turns down the heat of the car for the heat of a stranger's living room. The tow shows up, the car slides again and dies for good. The farmhouse remains alive. The owners return, find him in their kitchen, laugh at the absurdity, feed him pie with ice cream, make a bed, give him breakfast. He parts with a handshake and no Instagram follow. Decades later, he drives back, finds the porch light still on, meets the son who says the story became family scripture. They exchange numbers and Christmas greetings. The light stays on. This is a small, blinding anomaly in the ledger of what we call public life. It is an act of human decency that should be ordinary but reads now like folklore. There are three useful things to notice and then to watch yourself get numb to. 1. Systems fail. Phones were tethered to walls. Tow trucks were invisible gods. Cars were fragile. When the machine fails, a person walks and sometimes people answer. That is a fact. It is also a scandal because the machine was supposed to be the whole point. 2. Doors were unlocked. An unlocked door is not a metaphor. It is an obituary for a culture that once trusted the shape of another human's face at a kitchen table. That door invited a stranger in and did not explode into protocol, litigation, or a viral chain of outrage. It invited pie. 3. This ends with a reunion and a porch light that for one family never became a utilitarian bulb but a relic. The light is both literal and a small protest against the future we built. Surveillance, distance, gated pity. It will not scale. It will not become policy. It will not replace municipal failure. It will, however, comfort a man on a dark road and then, 40 years later, comfort a slightly different man who still remembers the smell of someone else's kitchen. We should be able to expect better from a country whose infrastructure pretends to be competent and whose politics pretends to value neighborliness. Instead, we store these stories like tokens, as if they were proof that humanity still exists in microcredit. We put them on the shelf and look away, because telling the truth that most things are random and mercy is accidental ruins the tidy narrative that someone else will fix it for us. A porch light kept burning by a family for reasons that feel larger than habit. An unlocked house that did not punish a kid for entering. Pie on a plate where state responsibility should have been. Call it luck, call it kindness, call it what you like. Call it one of the last small miracles that will not be turned into a headline with a follow-up. The nightmare is that these miracles are now exceptions we treat like antiques.
First world problems. There's a store in Alabama that owns a whole city block and its inventory is other people's bad travel decisions. It's called Unclaimed Baggage, a museum, a discount mall, and a weird civic ritual where Americans turn strangers' forgotten lives into markdowns. People treat it like a treasure hunt. A 55,000 square foot shrine to luggage gone astray, wedding dresses on racks, Gucci bags filled with Egyptian historical artifacts, Hoggle from Labyrinth hanging from the ceiling, a custom Nikon camera meant for the space shuttle. Also, two live rat snakes. Nothing says vacation like stashing reptiles in a duffel and forgetting them. Airlines try to reunite owners for months, then sell the bags wholesale. Owners get federal reimbursement up to about $4,700. You get the items for 20% to 80% off. Translation, someone's grief gets turned into someone else's bargain. We applaud. We call it retail therapy. We call it patriotism when it ships overseas. The store insists it's not a thrift shop. Thrift stores sell things people no longer want. Unclaimed Baggage sells things people loved enough to pack. That line is a perfect snapshot of modern consumer identity. Your stuff is a declaration of self until you forget it under an airplane seat pocket. Then it becomes my handbag bargain and your story becomes a reseller's profit margin. The artifacts read like a cultural timeline. In the 70s it was Walkmans and Joni Mitchell cassettes. Today it's AirPods, iPhones, and Taylor Swift tour merch. Fashion, tech, and heartbreak migrate together. A portrait of what we choose to carry and occasionally what we choose not to remember. There are superfans who go daily, resellers who flip Rolexes and lines that wrap around the building for the annual ski sale. People pitch tents in the parking lot for discounted ski boots, because camping overnight to save on footwear is apparently the new American rite of passage. Somewhere, a man is reselling Nikon binoculars while wearing a jacket that cost him $10 and zero dignity. The strangest moral calculus: will buy someone else's wedding dress on a whim, try it on in fluorescent light like a low-stakes bride, but refuse to buy it until an actual human proposes. We will happily inherit someone else's heirlooms, but not commit to a relationship we haven't negotiated in triplicate. Commitment is non-refundable. Designer duffels are flexible. For all the kitchen comedy, there's a weird tenderness to it. Phones are wiped of data, IDs and prescriptions are destroyed, eyeglasses are donated. Items get a second life. Meanwhile, we've monetized forgetting so completely that lost luggage now sustains an industry, a museum and a pilgrimage industry for bargain anthropologists. You can see it most plainly in the sign that reads, "It's like Christmas every day." That's the pitch. The truth is more specific. We live in a society where we're so buried in possessions that losing them becomes a business model, and the business model becomes civic entertainment. We don't just consume things, we consume the leftovers of people who tried to live a little, packed too much, and moved on. And in that fluorescent-lit wonderland, a woman tries on a wedding dress, twirls, decides not to buy it because the man hasn't proposed, and walks out with a bag of clothes instead. She keeps the fantasy on hold and takes the savings home. First world problem. We can buy back the world's lost things, but we can't buy the courage to ask a simple question.
A 19-year-old college freshman cleared airport security at Logan and walked toward a Thanksgiving surprise she planned for her family. Instead, immigration officials stopped her over a mysterious boarding pass issue, held her, and within 2 days, shipped her to Texas and then to Honduras, the country she left at age 7. The government points to a 2015 removal order. Her lawyer says the case was closed in 2017, and she never knew about any order. A federal judge briefly barred moving her out of the state and country, and then she was moved anyway. No proof of the old order has been offered. ICE declined to answer questions. This is not an isolated glitch. It is bureaucracy with a blunt instrument, rules applied without clarity, checks ignored, and lives erased in the name of procedure. Someone's college acceptance turns into a paper trail that chews through a childhood, and no one in charge feels the need to explain why. The ordinary cruelty is the point. Systems designed to sort and secure are also perfectly suited to misplace people, strip them of their claims, and pretend legality makes harm clean. Dreaming of business classes and family reunions became a deportation notice. That mismatch between human life and administrative indifference is the new normal. Call it efficiency if you like, call it lawful if that helps sleep at night. Either way, watch how small, unquestioned decisions pile up until they reroute an ordinary life out of the country and into someone else's checklist. The machinery keeps humming while one student loses everything she expected to have by the end of a semester.
From CNN, I took my shoes off and went for a barefoot hike. I couldn't believe what happened next. There's a woman in a Roswell parking lot who never wears shoes. She checks car emissions barefoot, rain or shine, and has been doing this since bell bottoms hid her feet. That image is comforting in a way, an ordinary human quietly flouting a tiny social contract. It's also ridiculous. We invented shoes, then concluded we'd been wrong for a few thousand years, and now need mats and documentaries to tell us to walk on grass. People are buying into grounding, earthing, the idea that the planet's electrons will swoop in like a tiny electrical janitor and clean up our inflammation. There's a movie, a godfather figure who'll sell you a mattress cover, and a chorus of testimonials powerful enough to populate a comment section. Scientists shrug, say research is emerging, and a Canadian program prescribes nature like it's a vitamin with better branding. The author of that CNN piece walked barefoot on a gravel trail, expected nothing, and slept through the night for the first time in ages. That's either a miracle, reflexology, placebo, or the cosmos briefly deciding to be useful. 2 hours outside a week boosts well-being by roughly 2%. Not the sort of headline that saves empires, but maybe enough to stop someone scrolling at 2 a.m. Here's the delicious irony. We crave meaning and control, so we reach for tiny rituals, removing shoes, buying grounding mats, hugging trees, as if proximity to dirt could solder together the parts of us that feel undone. The earth doesn't care about your free radicals. Neither does TikTok. But touching actual soil has the ancient advantage of being simple, cheap, and oddly stubborn against existential despair. Nihilism gets dramatic answers. Barefoot walking offers a humble one. You might not solve inflammation, cure loneliness, or negotiate immortality with the planet, but you could stub fewer toes than you thought, feel the grass under your feet, and sleep an uninterrupted 8 hours. If that's what it takes to feel marginally less absurd for a week, maybe that's enough. Or maybe it isn't. Either way, your feet remember the ground, whether your philosophy does or not.
Parents are being asked to underwrite the failures of a market that forgot responsibility long ago. Holiday conversations about grandchildren, home purchases, and mounting debt now come with line items, tax strategies, and spreadsheets. Affection has become a financial instrument. Love is labeled as liquidity. First question, can you afford to prop up a generation? The honest answer is less about feelings and more about risk management. Parents are told to inventory cash flow, emergency cushions, and long-term care as if family rescue missions were corporate debt restructuring. The moral urgency of helping is translated into a solvency test. Fairness is recoded into estate engineering. Uneven needs among siblings do not prompt shared political solutions, only actuarial gag rules. Give $50,000 now to one. Amend will so the others receive equivalent sums later. Conversation is reduced to a ledger entry and a carefully choreographed disclosure plan to prevent family unrest. Generosity becomes bookkeeping. Giving while alive is sold as both charity and tax arbitrage. Dollars in hand today supposedly buy more impact than dollars guaranteed to vanish into an estate tax calculation decades hence. The message, optimize the timing of affection to minimize taxation and maximize control. Attach values to gifts like price tags, 529 plans for education, personalized notes as justification receipts, and call it meaning. The cautionary advice reads like instructions for conditioned dependents. Do not enable bad habits. Support assets, not repair liabilities. The blunt implication is that a child can be a bad investment. When a human life is evaluated through the lens of return on capital, mercy is conditional and bailouts are rationed by moral hazard. Legal rules have been repurposed into family policy. Annual gift exclusions, currently marked by specific dollar thresholds, become ritualized allowances for the affluent to move wealth without immediate taxation. Paying a college or hospital bill directly is a loophole turned tool. A mortgage or credit card payoff is a gift that must be counted, tracked, and justified. The tax code acts like a conveyor belt that channels affection into estate planning. Trusts are marketed as guardians of heirs from their own appetites, structures designed to retain control over assets long after the donor's death. The instruction is clear. Give, but only within containers that prevent dissipation by marriage, creditors, or poor judgment. Parents are invited to micromanage adulthood, to police inheritance with institutional force, rather than address the social conditions that created precarity. Every recommended workaround is a bandage for systemic collapse. Medical debt, student loans, unaffordable housing. The cure is private transfer payments dressed up as thoughtful planning. The public shrugs, the marketplace celebrates the savvy grandparents who navigate exemptions, and the result is a deeper ossification of inequality. Private bailouts for some, permanent insecurity for others. The whole affair is a performance of competence in a world that has outsourced care to accountants. Family dynamics mutate into financial engineering. Philanthropy becomes tax strategy. Love becomes conditional on legal form. The fever dream of capitalism is a society where generational survival depends on who can best exploit policy loopholes and convert intimacy into instruments of wealth preservation.